From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of March, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll discuss the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrient Ag Solutions. And Nick Sider, extension entomologist from the University of Illinois, will join us to discuss the pest situation as it relates to commodity crops across the state of Illinois and how they have overwintered and what to expect from those pests that will be migrating in from the south very, very soon. And it all happens right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
In Chicago, March corn finished at $3.70¾ a penny higher for the day. The May at $3.65¾ unchanged. July at $3.68½ down a quarter. In December, $3.73 a penny and a quarter higher. March soybeans down 8¼ at $8.46¾. The May at $8.48¾, 10¾ lower. And November beans 8½ lower at $8.64½. The bean oil 4 cents lower. The bean meal down $2.70. Soft red winter wheat up a quarter at $5.07. The hard red down a penny and a quarter at $4.38½. Live cattle in the April down $4.50. That's the expanded limit. Feeder cattle still on the expanded limit have been there a good portion of the week. The March at $1.13 down $5.82½. April $6.42½ lower at $1.12.60. And lean hogs in the April contract down $4.50. Crude oil about 50 cents higher. Ethanol up a penny and a tenth. Gasoline 0.4 cents lower. And heating oil down a penny and 0.9 cents. The Dow off around 800 points, but this, of course, in the 2 o'clock hour as the president is beginning to make his press conference speech for the afternoon. That probably will change. The U.S. dollar is up 1.3, and the gold futures are $68.80 lower. We're now joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, to take a look at this marketplace. Hey, good afternoon to you. Wow, what a week it's been, Mike.
You know, we did see, I think, that food versus fuel mindset really take hold this week, especially late in the week, and it wasn't in a good way. We saw the unleaded gas hit a 35% break in this week. I think it's one of the biggest on record, and that easily took the cattle market down close to the Holcomb fire low, and those were the two big markets to really watch as the week developed. But out there in the perimeter, we saw the gold fall, we saw the silver fall, we saw the dollar rally almost 5% just this week alone, and we saw a deflationary trade start to develop. And it's all, I think, based upon the futures market trying to get in front of and having a strong perception of a big loss in demand here in real time because of all these massive cancellations and essentially our lockdown of our country from Europe and other places. And so they are essentially saying and assuming in these markets, look, our roads and restaurants are going to be a ghost town. That's why the unleaded gas was down so hard. That's why the cattle market was down so hard. While our gas at the pumps don't drop that much and our box beef prices actually firmed as the week progressed.
Is it too early to put this in perspective as it's related to China's recovery and the Western world moving into the coronavirus peak sometime later yet this spring?
Yeah, I think it is, because one of the things we've talked about the last couple of weeks, and I made a big point of it at the beef house, was the mortality rate. I think the mortality rate is going up, not a lot, but it's going up, and in Italy especially. And I think that's what makes me want to pull back and suggest to all the clients and subscribers is that don't be expecting any kind of price low until the meat market, the gold market, the dollar market tell you that the funds have gotten it wrong, that the actual demand is really very, very good, because China is indeed recovering. But I'm going to say be very careful here and don't try to pick bottom with the mortality rate being what it is in Italy. And with the governor of Ohio saying this morning and his doctor saying essentially we've got 100,000 cases we think of COVID-19 in Ohio, and that number is going to double in every 6 days. So these are the kind of things that you can't get your arms around at this point when it comes to actual demand being lost versus perceived demand being lost. The ag attaché in South Korea tried to do that. He said they're getting hit hard by both African swine fever and consumption dropping at restaurants, and now the COVID-19. Fortunately, since Australia has a real hit to the cattle herd from their drought, it doesn't look like we're going to lose much in beef exports, and we saw that in the corn export sales. We saw fresh sales this morning, and we had multiple sales in soybeans, even though China did hurt us with canceling both beans and pork this week.
Yeah, so do you just stand aside the marketplace?
Yeah, this is the thing that I'd like to distinguish, and I thank you for asking that because very few people have. There are not going to be any recommended hedges when there is a discount in the futures market, and especially with the livestock. When you have a cash index at the feeder cattle market trading 128, and you've got futures in March and April at 112, 113, there's no premium to hedge at this point. So unless you want to get just a cheap basic put in place and try and ride the last part of this wave down, or if you think it's going to last longer than 20 or 30 days, do it that way. But otherwise, this is a sit and hold situation because the market is dialing in this hit to demand in real time.
And before I let you go, beans were off 8 to 10 cents for the day. Corn stayed steady. What was it? Was it just the cancellation with beans?
Yeah, I think that was the heart and soul of it. And Todd, keep in mind, we've got a pork and bean trade that's been around for about 6 or 7 months. They go up and down together because they're both related to China. And I think on that note, we do have some bright spots out there when it comes to the weather side, the supply side, and even some of the demand side, that maybe the market will start looking at that as we go down the pike late in the week next week or the first of next week, depending on what happens with the president and how bad the disease and the virus increases here in the next 7 to 10 days.
There will be those that have to make cash sales of something just to make sure they're liquid for paying bills. Do they need to do anything other than just eat that at the moment and wait?
I would say to them that you would want to be on point for buying that back very, very quickly once you saw the meats, the gold, and the dollar turn, because we are pushing that global fiscal stimulus into the market. And if China's recovering at the same time, maybe we won't lose that much demand after all.
What's your takeaway for this week? Anything?
No, I think the food versus fuel is working. I don't like the mortality rate. That's my simple takeaway at this point. I think the analysis on track, except for the mortality rate, gone up 3.5%, 3.6% in some of these countries and almost 6% in Italy, a lot higher than what China was saying.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You too, my friend.
Mike Zuzalo is with GlobalAnalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium for this Friday afternoon.
Thank you to everyone who attended the 30th annual WILL Ag Outlook Conference at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Special thanks to our sponsors, Strategic Farm Marketing, and Bates Commodities. We appreciate your support. More information at willag.org.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like at willag.org. Well, it's not been a particularly rough winter in our part of the world across the state of Illinois. And Nick Sider joins us now, entomologist with Illinois Extension, to discuss what that means for the coming growing season as it relates to these pests of crops. Hey, Nick, thanks so much for being with us. I suppose we probably should look forward and backward both as we have our discussion today.
Yeah, it's as far as Illinois winters go, it's been a relatively easy one for our insect pests. You know, not a lot of hard freezes, not a lot of extended frigid temperatures like we had in 2019. Certainly shouldn't have been any obstacle to any of the pests that we have overwintering here. And the other thing we need to think of when we think of overwintering aspects, you know, winter temperatures on insects, is what's going on to our south. They've had some pretty mild winters to our south as well, which allows a chance for those kind of early season migrants to get here maybe just a little bit earlier.
Yeah, so we think about things like what, the black cutworm, I suppose, which mm-hmm. travels in from the south. And can you explain that a little bit? And cool temperatures there or temperature impacts, and it's been so wet, I'm wondering whether, you know, sometimes insects just drown. So
That is true. And with black cutworm, what we have is an insect that it doesn't overwinter here. It completes its life cycle and survives the winter down further south where we're below that kind of heavy freeze line. So the earlier they can get going down south and the more of them survive the winter down south, the earlier we will see them. And generally the earlier we see them in Illinois, the more of an issue we're going to have. Water certainly has a major impact too. That tends to be a little bit more local, heavily dependent on the microclimate in an area. Certainly you have an insect that's overwintering in the soil residue and that floods out, becomes saturated. That can be pretty tough on them. But that tends to be more of a local impact.
Okay, so that's one I was thinking about. The bean leaf beetle comes to mind for me too. For soybeans, I don't know which ones you're concerned about or watching closely at this time.
As far as insects, the early season migrants we would be worried about, black cutworm, true armyworm, certainly then bean leaf beetle to an extent, although they survive a little better here in Illinois.
Tell me about this early season. What do producers need to think about?
The big thing you need to think about is simply your scouting and especially paying attention to those fields, maybe where you get suboptimal weed control or where you're able to plant early and you're planting into a field that has some weeds that are dying. When those plants are in the process of dying, whatever's feeding on that plant is going to have an opportunity to migrate over to your corn or your soybean.
All right, so what are we watching for in that case?
We're watching for black cutworm and true armyworm in particular in cases like that. Also, some of the other species, variegated cutworm, comes to mind. We had some issues with that last year. That tends to be more of a problem if we get into a later planting type scenario.
So if you're going to scout, are we just scouting and watching? Are we doing yellow sticky traps? What kinds of things?
There's two things. You can watch the moth trapping reports that Kelly Estes has, particularly for black cutworm. That will give you when you've had a significant flight in your area. From that, you can do the degree day calculation to determine the actual cutting date, when you need to be looking at cutting in corn in particular. With those insects, they tend to be very difficult to find during the day, the larvae, especially when they're smaller. Usually what you're going to find first is the damage. When you have damage from small larvae on corn, it's going to bore some holes into the corn, get a little bit of shot holing with cutworm. As it becomes later, of course, when they reach that cutting size, they're actually going to cut the plant and the plant will fall over. And that's where when you find that damage, then you need to be excavating the top layer of that soil and looking for the actual larva, which spends the day in hiding from predators. They are active and do their feeding at night.
Turn your attention to cover crops for a moment. Have you been doing research on them?
We have. We've been doing actually several projects looking at insect management in cover crops and both what we're finding out there and whether or not we're going to need to treat these cover crop fields a little bit differently in terms of management, in terms of scouting. So far, a lot of our efforts have focused on cereal rye because we have a lot of cereal rye in Illinois right now, and looking at soybean fields following cereal rye because that's been the more common practice. What we've seen so far suggests that the risk of insect damage to soybean following cereal rye is relatively minor, which maybe isn't all that surprising when you consider that soybean and rye are not that closely related. Where we probably have more of an impact, you know, more of a potential risk of insect damage is where we're going to have corn following cereal rye, where you have a grass following a grass. Or if for some reason you had soybean following a legume, like a clover, which we don't have a lot of that particular practice going on in Illinois. But that's where you would expect to potentially have an issue. And we're looking at several different factors. We're looking at surveys to see what's out there in Illinois right now, compare the insect complex in cover crop fields with non-cover crop conventional fields. We're also looking at the effect of termination timing of the cover crop in relation to the cash crop, which when you think about practices that we have with cover crops, that's one of the ones that could be the most impactful on insect damage in that cash crop. What we probably want to try to avoid is a situation where the cover crop is dying right as those soybean or corn plants are in their most vulnerable stage, in the seedling stage, kind of like we talked about with cutworm and weeds. The same thing could happen with the cover crop, where you have those plants dying and insects or another animal, slugs for instance, are actively feeding on them. That could give them a chance to transition over to that cash crop. So we're looking at that effect of termination timing, both in corn and starting over the next couple of years in soybean, to develop some management recommendations.
You mentioned surveys. Do you need farmers and cooperators?
We have a lot of farmer cooperators identified already. In fact, we probably have about as many fields as we can get sampled. That's not to say, if you're not interested in doing some work on that topic, to get in contact with us. We have other projects coming. We have a lot of work, a lot of, you know, potential information to gather on how to treat these cover cropped fields. What we're really trying to do with this is to make sure we get our management recommendations right, so that we don't cause a problem by trying to solve other problems with erosion, with nutrient reduction runoff, some of these great benefits that we can get from cover crops.
Where do people go to find this information?
Certainly the Nutrient Loss Reduction podcast that you've done, put out an episode on it last year. The bulletin is a good source of information to follow for this, but we're hoping to develop a lot more information on the cover crop front in particular.
You may find the bulletin at bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu, and that will transition sometime later this growing season to Crop Doc, and you'll be able to find it at the farmdoc.illinois.edu website. Hey, thanks, Nick Sider, extension entomologist from the University of Illinois, for joining me today. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On this Friday afternoon, we're joined by Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible to talk about the weather forecast. Hey, it's a beautiful day. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. And I'd like to see a whole lot more beautiful days in a row, but I'm not so sure we're going to get that right away.
Tell me about the near-term pattern.
Well, the near-term pattern is shifted over what we've seen throughout much of winter and very early spring this year. And the new pattern is set up over Alaska and Hawaii. And what it is we call it an omega block. So if you can just imagine the Greek letter omega, where the jet stream dips in the formation of that letter such that it goes down to over Hawaii, then races up to Alaska, then dips down over California. Now, that pattern then spreads out across the rest of the United States, and the end result of a pattern like that is, for us, quite a bit of Gulf moisture, and it also means more frequent low-pressure systems. We're going to get the first one of these coming to us late tonight on Friday and then into the day on Saturday. We might be on the cold enough side of that we could be seeing some wet snowflakes around here. But our temperatures just aren't cold enough. I mean, that's been a problem all winter. And by Sunday, when the sun pops back out, yeah, it's going to be a little chilly, highs in the mid-40s. But any snow that does accumulate, which I'm not anticipating much, is going to basically melt pretty quickly. Now, we're going to get a nice, few days of weather next week. Monday, Tuesday, and the Wednesday of next week, temperatures rebound back up into the 50s, maybe even the lower 60s. But with that omega block and the systems coming through California, we just stay active. And I'll tell you something about California. They had their driest February on record, and now they're getting a lot of precipitation. A lot of the folks are like, oh, we need as much as we possibly can get. And I'm telling them, no, you don't, because you'll get massive flooding problems if they do. But the Sierra Nevadas, which are right now in some locations over 15 feet in deficit in snowfall, might erase about a third of that over the next 7 days with some big snowfall. So that's what that pattern is doing to us and what it's doing out west. And it's also keeping the south very wet, too.
Can I say that I like omega block way better than I like polar vortex, just off the top?
You can say that. I agree.
Through the end of the month, how do we do?
Well, we tend to stay with that pattern for a while. In other words, the word block, by definition in meteorology, is that the pattern stays the way it is for at least 10 days. And more often than not, these blocks tend to last for longer than that. So we're going to split the country almost west to east, but a bit more of a north-south flavor. I guess that's kind of easy. We're going to keep the western and northern part of the United States on the cooler side of things and the south and the eastern side on the warmer side of things because of that pattern. And it looks as though we're going to keep things wet. Now, compared to a year ago, believe it or not, we're not as wet on the whole as we were back in March of 2019. And we certainly didn't have the monster cyclone that was going through today a year ago out in and over the Missouri River Basin. If you remember that major flooding event, which started, it ended up being a $10.6 billion flooding disaster. That was a year ago right now. Well, we don't quite have that same magnitude of the cyclone, but the Central Plains today are picking up quite a bit of snow on some snow-free ground, which means that as we work our way through March, even though it's not quite as wet, nor are the soil moisture anomalies as high, they're still high compared to the 30-year average, which means our spring flooding threat is still an issue that we're going to be discussing for a while.
And then if you look out to the summer, El Nino, La Nina, anything that we should know?
Yeah, I think you're going to hear a lot of meteorologists, myself included, talking about how right now we got warm water piling up over by Australia, and we've seen some cooler water emerge at times off the west coast of South America and off the west coast of North America. Now, here's what we all have to pay attention to. If we watch those waters cool farther, in other words, get more cool from South America toward the Baja of California, up along the west coast of the United States into the Gulf of Alaska, if that expands and the trade winds respond. Remember, those trade winds, which run on the equator, go from the east to the west. If they're fast, that tends to do a couple things. It slows down the global winds, which slows down the jet stream, which blocks the atmosphere up. Now, if that does so in a pattern that's consistent with La Nina-like behavior, then that block tends to set up with a trough on the west coast and a ridge in the Midwest. And we tend to get hotter and drier in that situation. Now, if that main ridge axis goes right through the Dakotas over toward Minnesota, we're scorched. We'll be very hot and dry. If it just slides 500, 1,000 miles to the west, we get northwest flow and plenty of thunderstorms and record yields. So no one has this pattern down yet. I'm just telling you and others, hey, let's watch it, because it's been a while since we've seen the Central Pacific, and especially along the coast of the Americas, giving us a cool signal. And it's just something to pay attention to. Nothing, though, right now that I would make any sort of a bet on.
Argentina has gotten rainfall that alleviated some problems there. What's your assessment of South America?
Well, we saw them pull back on their total productivity out of this year. So production for corn and soybeans pulled back away from some of the highs they had, because for the last 15 to 20 days, we've been hotter and drier, not only in southern Brazil, but in Argentina's main growing areas. In the forecast, Argentina, like you said, is going back over wet. Southern Brazil staying on the drier side of things, which we need to keep an eye on because it's also quite warm there. But northern Brazil, Mato Grosso, you know, this area is showing up with wetter than average conditions. So what we need to watch in South America is if by the end of March and the beginning of April, if there are any indications that the monsoon is going to slow down, because if it does, we could put that safrinha crop in danger of finishing under drought conditions. So we'll watch it carefully. I have no signal right now to give me any sort of an indication if it will or if it won't, but that's what I'll be paying attention to over these coming weeks.
Hey, thanks so much. You have a great week.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions. Joined us here on this Friday afternoon edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand at willag.org, willag.org. There you'll find our Commodity Week program in its entirety. Our panelists for the week included Kurt Kimmel this week, along with Wayne Nelson and Merrill Crowley. Commodity Week is coming up next on our home radio station. You'll find it on many of these stations over the weekend and, of course, online, on demand, anytime you'd like.
Thank you to everyone who attended the 30th Annual WILL Ag Outlook Conference at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Special thanks to our sponsors, Farm Credit Illinois and The Andersons, Inc. We appreciate your support. More information at WILLAG.org.